Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we'll be looking at all the different issues that you find important in your life. Now, I'm going to give a number, 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. If you have issues that you believe are important for your well-being and for society's well-being, things that I could hopefully give some input to, I'll be happy to. Just give us a call. Normally, I take most of the program to give you some of the latest on health and nutrition update information. I'm going to do less of that today so I can take more calls. And starting in 2 weeks, I'm going to go back to having some guests on. And I took a break for about 2 months from guests so I could bring you up on all these other topics that generally don't have enough time in the regular course of a program to share with you. This comes, for instance, from the biotech activist, and it's by Robert Wiseman. And the Consumer Federation of America is at a crossroads set up in 1968 to advocate in Washington, D.C. for consumer interest. The Federation is being consumed by Washington's corporate culture. Will it seek to reverse course and get back to its consumer roots, or will it become just another corporate front group? Perhaps the hottest consumer issue of the next few years, genetically engineered foods, will severely test its resolve. Who's in charge of this issue at Federation? None other than Carol Tucker Foreman, who during the previous decade worked as a lobbyist for Monsanto, making sure that the highly controversial genetically engineered bovine growth hormone made it into our milk supply without labeling. We see no evidence that Foreman represents anyone other than herself, says Ronnie Cummins, National Director of Organic Consumer Association, and we resent the fact that the media describes Foreman as a leading spokesperson for America's consumers on food safety issues. But President Clinton sees it differently. Last month, Clinton and Gore administration nominated Foreman to be the U.S. consumer advocate to the Biotech Consultative Forum, a group formed at the behest of the biotech industry. The forum, dominated by experts partial to the industry, have prepared all of the U.S. European Union summits on biotechnology. John Stauber, managing director of the PR Watch, says that the problem for the biotech industry is that genetically engineered foods were pushed onto the market too fast, the result of political and economic train wreck internationally. European consumers don't want the technology with or without labeling. They just don't like it. And to ensure that the no genetic engineered foods virus doesn't spread across the Atlantic, the industry needs impartial so-called consumer advocates to speak on its behalf. Well, in Foreman, the Federation, they have a winner. Foreman believes that agricultural biotechnology has the potential to provide enormous benefits to society. But she realizes that American consumers are skeptical, even cynical, with regards to the benefits of genetically engineered foods. When it comes to food risk, she believes that the population tends to be extremely risk adverse and not always rational about food. But she wants biotech foods on the market, and the only question is how to get it. With funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, she's organized a project with the Federation, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, Consumers Union, and the Center for Science and Public Interest, together to develop an optimal regulatory regime to ensure the safety of genetically engineered foods. The project has hired a University of Texas law professor to draft legislation. Foreman is skittish on the question of mandatory labeling of genetic engineered products. She's refused to support legislation currently pending in Congress that would require mandatory labeling. Now, so what does it mean? Well, first off, go back about a year. A year ago, Michael Jacobson of the Center for Science and the Public Interest and the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, Consumers Union, got together. And they all decided genetically engineered foods would be a good thing. Unfortunately, at every step was the genetic engineering interest. Those of us who oppose genetic engineering of the foods, who have raised many questions, I've done 19 programs over the last 4 years on genetic engineering of foods, we have never once been invited to any of these forums to present our information, not to argue, not to bash anyone, but in a constructive and a polite form to say, hey, let's take a look at some of the things that need to be addressed, and what are your responses to these? That has never occurred. In fact, when I've called around to ask all the other people who have concerns about genetic engineering, including qualified scientists, not one has been invited to give their input. So when we hear names like Consumers Union and Center for Science Public Interest and U.S. Public Interest Research Group aligning themselves with the Rockefeller Foundation that is notorious for its promotion of the genetic engineered rice that launched the Green Revolution, which virtually destroyed the Indian sustainable agriculture. And then you ask, don't these people have any capacity to look at the history of these organizations? Obviously not. And obviously there's a lot of money that's being given to different groups. So, in the end, there is a face that approaches the consumer that has been trusted in the past. And it's a face and a voice that says, there is nothing that we can find that should frighten you so much that we should impede the progress by using genetic engineered foods. To the contrary, we're very much in support of genetic engineered foods if done correctly, and we believe it is being done correctly and can save lives, millions of lives, hundreds of millions of lives. And because these are not the corporate leaders of the biotechnology industries, but rather heretofore respected scientists and public health advocates, it is one of the most masterful PR, duplicitous programs I've ever seen in my career. Clearly, this is a Trojan horse. So be aware that the voices who are going to be promoting the biotechnology's agenda will not be those voices that have been visible as as those that are the shills for the industry. These will be people that have come historically from the ranks of consumer advocates. Now, is it possible they simply individually believe that genetically engineering should be put on the fast track? Sure. It doesn't mean because they support it there's some maniacal conspiracy. Doesn't even mean that they profited financially. But it does mean that they have made judgments without looking at all the facts. And that concerns me. Once again, people making up their mind before all the facts are in. Because I don't believe that any of these groups would be that foolish if they saw all the literature that we have. More than enough reasonable doubt. Let me just give you an idea of how it works in just everyday lay language. Let's go back to the 1960s. In the 1960s, there was concern that we could not feed the world's starving. We were looking at Bangladesh and other countries that were grossly impoverished, where millions of people were suffering from malnutrition, and anywhere from 5 to 10 million people a year were dying of preventable conditions, including malnutrition. At that time, the bioengineers got together and they came up with, through foundations, including the Rockefeller Foundation, which was in the Ford Foundation, which were so they thought, this is great. The trouble is that it wasn't a matter of having starvation due to a lack of food. It was starvation due to the improper utilization of natural resources, which deprived the masses of sustainable agriculture, which they could have eaten. For instance, in Bangladesh, they had one of the largest sources of fish farms in the world. They had so much fish that they were exporting it all over the place, and yet their own citizens were too poor to afford the fish. So when you look at who was controlling the economy, running the country, the very insulated elite groups profited immensely from these projects, but at the cost of overlooking the basic nutritional needs of their own inhabitants. So we'd have the Beatles doing a fundraising concert, which didn't feed anybody, but neither did the food project or the hunger project. And once I asked Werner Erhard, I said, you've raised millions and millions of dollars. How many people have actually been fed? Well, it's not about actually feeding people. It's about raising their consciousness. Well, if you're starving, your consciousness is raised. You know, you just need food. We had no shortages of this nonsense. But in any case, let me use India. India had historically been poor, but it had not suffered from the form of malnutrition that was about to face it. And there was a simple reason. You cannot use a Western standard of valuing life by what you own or possess in these cultures, because these are class caste cultures, with the untouchables being the lowest caste that can't get a position, at least at that time could not. They were the ones who were relegated to cleaning out toilets, to sweeping streets, to picking up garbage, but they wouldn't be allowed any other job, nor were they allowed to live in certain areas, nor could they marry people in certain areas and of other backgrounds. Very, very, very racist society. But that has historically been what many of these cultures are. And by the way, for all my friends who told me about the utopian humanitism of Cuba, friends, sell that nonsense to someone else. God, what a difference of reality checks. There is rampant racism in Cuba, rampant, between those who are black and those who are light-skinned. But I won't get into that at this point. I'm saving that for a commentary on the so-called perfect ideology and the utopian nature that people have been praising. I'll give a perspective on that. In any case, we don't see what we don't want to see. We only see what we want to see. And if we don't want to see something, we won't see it. If we don't see our biases, then we have no bias. If we don't want to see our limitations, then we'll avoid our limitations. We'll focus on someone else's limitations, not our own. So in these societies, rampant racism. By selecting a class. And when you're in that class, you're in that class for life. One of the things that these people were allowed to do, of all classes, was to grow food. And what you would have, let's say you had 1,000 acres in the Punjab area. You would be able to each maybe have 50 acres. And on that 50 acres, you might grow lentils, split peas, a wheat, a rice, maybe basmati rice. And someone else might have orchards of almond trees, cashew trees. Cashews are very big in India. And someone else might grow fruits. Well, now what would happen is, and historically what would happen, is that you were poor as far as not having money, but you were not poor as far as your capacity to barter and have common collective exchanges. And in essence, every community was a form of a collective, where you would take your cashews, since you were growing far more than what your family could use, and you would offer those for other commodities you did not have. So you would get your soris, and someone else would give you your candles, and someone else would give you your sandals, and someone else would give you your rice. And the person growing the rice would get their cooking oil from someone. So everybody had quite a lot as far as the basic sustaining factors. Shelter, an extended family, not a large family, generally speaking, from all the interviews I've done, and lots of different foods. In fact, if you've looked in some of these communities where you'll have maybe 50,000 people to 100,000 people living, remember, India has a population 3 times larger than America. But then overlap India to America, and you see, gee whiz, that's an awful lot of people for the amount of land. what would happen would be people had a very specific quality of life. They didn't look to go outside of their system. They merely wanted to make sure that their basics were covered. Beyond that, a great deal of time and energy was spent on their spiritual connections. They could spend 6 hours a day in meditation, and the Brahmins, the highest of the high, would spend almost all their waking hours in the service of their spirit. And then the yogis, who would go from town to town with their bowl, and people would put their food in the bowl. But there were no starving yogis. That's the way it was. Now, visualize being a person going there and saying, gee, there's an awful lot of people. What's the average income? Well, probably about $100 a year. Whoa, they are poor. They're poor financially, but take a look. They're not hungry. They have an extended family. They have a deep cultural and spiritual connection to their community and their land and their history. They are serene. Yes, they have their conflicts. The Hindu and Muslims has historically been at each other's throats. But where they are of one type, let's say a Hindu village, there is stability. We didn't want to see that, because the only way most Americans see anything is by what they considered a normal standard, their comfort level, and they can't see anything that would be comforting. So in came the new type of rice. The new type of rice was fine. It was, gave you a little more rice than what you would normally get, and what did have some protective benefits from some of the insects. But there was not a whole lot of insects anyhow, because generally they rotated their crops there. They used natural manures. They couldn't afford to pesticide. They were too poor. And they did almost everything by oxen. They couldn't afford a tractor. A tractor would cost more than the entire village's total income for a year. But through foundation grants and through International Monetary Fund loans, they managed to take large tracts of land and plant them all in rice. But what happened to all the sustainable agriculture that was on that same 1,000 acres? Well, it ended, and it ended rather abruptly. What we did in Russia, which is one of the greatest rapes of any nation in history, of its resources, and we were not stupid. Every time you see one of these columns about, we didn't really know the Harvard team that went in there, they thought privatization, you know, and the shock of the letting the free market prices reign and eliminating subsidies and stability in fuel and food and rent, we thought that they would do better at that. Nonsense. Don't think for a second that there were not people who were fully aware that once you threw everyone who had lived for the last 76 years as a welfare recipient, and that's all Russia was one giant welfare state with the worst quality work in the world on just about everything, and gross apathy, because why work? You didn't have to. Everything was paid for. You couldn't be fired from a job, no matter how drunk. And if you had 60 guys sitting around drinking vodka while one guy worked, well, so what? You know, you didn't have to compete in the international marketplace, so there was full employment. Of course it was full unemployment. Anyone who couldn't be employed in regular industry could be in the military. If not then a bureaucracy. But at what cost? An enormous cost. They knew what would happen. But they also knew that they could profit from it. Estimates run as high as $3 trillion has been looted out of Russia by the people smart enough to see when you throw people into chaos, who benefits from chaos. And they have, and including a lot of bankers. But in any case, something similar happened in India. How do you take an economy that had been poor but sustaining for a long time and then have a single crop, rice? And take away, what happened to their almond, their herb gardens? Gone. Their tea fields? Gone. What happened to their own form of rice? That's gone. Everything's gone. All because our smart guys wanted to put in a rice. And they did. They made the front page of all the major magazines. Well, that was okay, but then you had to get in the equipment. Now, since you were planting the same crop every year, the insects developed a pattern of coming back every year. And then they had to use pesticides. They hadn't used pesticide before. Now it was every year more and more. And the equipment started breaking, and they started to have to get new equipment and larger equipment. And then the fields became less fertile, so they had to get more acreage. Within a period of 15 years, it was one of the great ecological disasters. Well waters were polluted with pesticides. The soil was grossly eroded. The economies were in tatters because people could no longer live in their villages. They had to send their sons and daughters off. And many of those daughters ended up being prostitutes. And many of the sons ended up being, in effect, chattel labor in brick places and making bricks. And also in weaving, working 14 to 16 hour days in dusty, toxic rooms making rugs. And they were 8 and 10 years old. Before, that hadn't happened like that at that extent. But now there was massive poverty. The government wasn't there to subsidize it, because the government was part of the problem. So, and one of the most corrupt bureaucracies and most inept bureaucracies in the world was in India. So that is one idea of what genetic engineering did. It nearly destroyed an entire subculture of the poor people's livelihoods, displaced them, caused many of them to have larger families. The idea was, well, if they're this poor, who's going to feed us when we get older? If we have more children, then those children can go out and work and then bring some of that money back. So the population began to expand tremendously. Were there pressures brought to bear by religious leaders? No. Were politicians here taking a look to see what our technology was doing? No. No, it was one of those situations where we just smiled and winked and said, aren't we really great? So I want Consumers Union to do their homework. You didn't do it when you allowed Stephen Barrett to sit in on your committees when chiropractic was attacked by your organization. That was one of the dark and ugly chapters in your history. A history that also has had some very bright and very responsible directives that has given people on how to buy a stereo or how to buy a car. But when you talk about things you don't know about, and you allow quackbusters, and by the way, all the quackbusters were sued this week in a massive suit, charging racketeering, RICO actions, mail fraud. It's a whole list. I saw the indictments or the lawsuit, and it's massive, and they were all served. This is the first time. I would guess now that there are going to be thousands of doctors and journalists and everyone coming out of the woodwork and saying, it's about time that we hit these people back. Up to this point, all the lawsuits have been one way. Hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits the quackbusters have filed against people and harassed them and condemned them. Well, Time Magazine should have been included in that lawsuit because it's given a form to these quackbusters. And now comes the fun part. I was part of the orchestration of the lawsuit against the AMA. Let's see what role I'll play in this one in providing important documents, including documents I managed to have on hand from the AMA, showing people who are those quackbusters who wanted to work with those files that the court said should have been destroyed. Let's see what that does. In any case, the quackbusters all over America have been sued. And these people, I've spoken with the lawyers, these people are hitting them and then hitting them again and getting them into the depositions and discoveries, and there's going to be a lot of documents coming out, and that financial trail is going to be found. Who finances these people? Who's behind the scenes? Let's just see if the pharmaceutical industry keeps popping its head up or some of its foundations. And if you think this won't happen, it was the million documents that were discovered through the litigation with the AMA and its 11 other major medical organizations that was used to end up causing it to be found guilty and violating the Sherman Antitrust Act and restraint of trade, and clear up to the Supreme Court, the AMA lost. Now, you wouldn't have known this from the New York Times or any of the other publications because of the little interest they showed in the major media's virtually non-coverage of the story. But this is going to be proving interesting over the next 2 to 3 years that this is going to be going on. I'll keep you posted at appropriate times. It's just been launched now. I told you a lot of stuff was going to... I told you 6 months ago the American Dental Association was going to be sued. They have been. And now individual dentists are going to be sued by the thousands. Thousands. And next up is pediatricians. They're the good people to sue because they're the people who have put your kid on Ritalin. Antibiotics for inner ear infection. Vaccines. Boy, if there's a group that deserves to be held to accountability, it is the pediatricians. Those lawsuits are being drawn up now as we speak. Because one of the things I'm doing is running around the country helping organize a lot of this activity. I'll keep you posted when those suits, which we're planning on launching in about 4 months. And there's going to be some big class actions coming down. So it's time for people who have been abusing the public trust to be held accountable and let then the courts decide what that accountability issue is. In any case, here we have the genetic engineering people who are telling us they're making us a better world. I haven't seen it. Have you? They're telling us they're helping end starving. No, end starving by having a proper distribution of resources and to give what funding is available to build proper reforestation programs, proper and technically feasible domes, greenhouses, so you can have crops in 8 days. 21 days, you've got very nutritious edible greens. 52 days, you've got a full mature crop. If you started putting these in every village with well water in these areas that you say you're so concerned about, then that genetic engineered seed is meaningless. Right now, the seeds that they're creating anyhow are not capable of being reused from a fruit. You can't take a peach and take the peach pit and grow a peach tree from it. Now you can, but with these new genetic varieties, you cannot. They create a sterile line. And so genetic engineering, in my opinion, is of food in particular, is one of the most greatest concerns I have. So concerned I am that I'm writing now a major screenplay for a very important documentary. My current documentary is being worked on as we speak, and it'll be ready for when I get back to New York next weekend. I'm going to be spending 3 hours. It's currently 3 hours and 15 minutes long. We'll get it down to 3 hours, and I'll see it. And I brought in some top editor and creative people to work on it. It's powerful. Oh, it's powerful. It is. It's gonna shake some cobwebs out of some very complacent people's heads when you watch this. But we got to do one on genetic engineering also. So that's my take on that. All right. So be very careful, because the people are going to be coming to your door through television and articles and interviews who have impeccable backgrounds as consumer advocates. They are the ones who are now the front people for the industry. So watch out. It's coming. I'm Gary Nall, talking about health and nutrition issues. And we're going to take calls. Our number, and unfortunately, because I'm still not available to take calls all over the country, and I did miss being on Roy of Hollywood. I'm sorry, I was on a plane and I was not able to get to a microphone or even to PFW this week. But next week I'll be on KPFK for the full 6 hours, and then PFW on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday nights. Let's go to the phone, see who we have online and what the issues are. Hi, I'm Gary Nall. Your turn. What's your name, please?
Hello, Mr. Nall.
Yeah, what's your name?
Daryl McPherson. How are you?
Good.
I'm really glad to get you for two reasons. One, I wanted to know whether anyone in your office let you know that Nelson Mandela was under treatment for prostate cancer using revolutionary radiation. I believe after surgery. I just saw a blurb in the newspaper.
No, I'm not familiar with that. I did say that I would make myself available to George Harrison if someone reaches him. I have not been even able to have a phone call with anyone, nor
right.
even on the email. But as of tomorrow, I'll be able to get my emails. And as of Monday, I will be able to make phone calls. Now, as far as Mandela, there's a couple things you can do. The first thing you should do is to go to my webpage under GaryNall.com.
Yes.
Look under iatrogenic episodes.
Right.
Go to cancers.
Mm-hmm.
Then go to prostate cancers. Then go to combination therapies. There it's either surgery and radiation, surgery chemotherapy, radiation and chemotherapy, and see how many studies I have that show that radiation and chemotherapy do not whatsoever increase the lifespan or quality of life and have devastating side effects and actually produce secondary cancers in the body. So at least you can show that the therapy he is being given is quackery, and then go to the Clinician's Handbook of Natural Healing, look under cancer, then prostate cancer, and see from peer-reviewed journal studies, there's 25,000 of them in the book, which natural nutrients have been proven by the most rigorous of scientific protocol to impact upon prostate cancer or hypertrophy of the prostate, both, or PSA levels, and bring them down. Third, speak with Diane Finney in my office, who does a really great job. She's the one who's responsible for helping all the people in the health support groups, and we're in the last stages of our last health support group right now. But we have been, one of the nice things about the health support group, and this is why I did it, and why 10,000 people have been in it, is we've been able to collect data on what happens when people who are not treated for disease have a change in their disease from a healthy and natural lifestyle. And we have people who had very high PSAs, who had prostate cancer, testicular cancer, other cancers, and now don't. They're normal. And mind you, we didn't treat any of those people. Then, so that shows that there are these people, and she would put these people in touch with Mandela, and they can speak directly, you know, about their own and have their own medical records to say, hey, I had prostate cancer, and they wouldn't do this to me, and I said no, and I tried this protocol, and just gee whiz, I don't have prostate cancer anymore, and I'm feeling fine. So that's a third point. Fourth point is contact Luann Panessi at the Metropolitan Wellness Center and ask her, and she can only do this with a physician, but ask her to speak with Mandela and Mandela's physician about my prostate cancer protocol.
Right.
And last, because I do have one, I cannot give it to the general public.
I
can't give it over the air. But every day of the week, physicians, Orthodox physicians from all over America, contact me for protocols. And I have over 100 protocols for major illnesses. Now, these are not protocols of having some vegetable juice, needing a vegetarian diet. These are using very complex modalities, but natural modalities. None of them are toxic. And so that would be the final thing, and Mandela could also speak with some physicians who use it. So that's the approach you could take if you need varying levels of authentication and understanding. All right.
Well, thank you so much. And could you also, with regard to your nursing home protocol, as soon as it's possible, get that information out so that we could.
It is out.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to say this exactly correctly. Okay, if someone contacted your office from a nursing home, would they be able to get the protocol that way?
Yes, they would.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Noll.
Yeah, and before we take another call, there is another thing. I don't have, I can't get an email, I'm sorry, but I did have a phone call with Gary Krupp in my office, and here's something we have done. in a given year, I probably have between 5,000 to 10,000 individuals that I try in some level to help who are indigent. They're poor. And in the last couple of months, I've been trying to help people get out of psychiatric hospitals, like Pilgrim State. We have two people who are in the news that we've gotten out. And one man was just in my office in New York yesterday, and they put me on the phone with him and had a long talk with him. And now he is going into a holistic recovery program to help recover from the damage done from the neuroleptics, which I believe should be banned, and the electroconvulsive therapy, which should never have been created, let alone used. And he was given both. But this person doesn't have a nickel. Now, one guy, in fact, we had to go clear to the one of the top people in the Senate, and then go through judges, you name it. We've had to do everything we could just to get one guy who's in there now out because they keep giving electroconvulsive therapy. And there's nothing really wrong with this person. Normal life events are not the same as some form of organic brain disease. And if a person can use the benefits of counseling and a more calm environment to regain a different perspective that all of us need it from time to time, then that is a healthier environment. So we're trying to get him out. But we can't get him out until he has a place to go. Now, we do have a place, found a place upstate where he can go, which is a licensed facility that will give a more holistic protocol. And it's run by a psychiatrist. But it's not cheap. He didn't have a nickel. Most of these people are broke. And so, unfortunately, getting them out is not the full answer. Getting them to where they can have a place to stay. Because who's going to want someone who's been in a mental institution, who's been labeled and hence stigmatized? Who's going to want them around? Well, they're going to end up on the streets. And then the first time one of the people does something inappropriate, then suddenly it's lock them all back up again. Don't dump these people back on the streets. They should be in jails. Remember, you have a highly reactionary public. It doesn't take the time to look into these issues. They just, you know, they paint them all with the same brush. As if, you know, we don't need them. Until suddenly it's their son or daughter. And then suddenly it's, well, no, they're really a human being. Oh, but all the others on the streets are just animals, right? Eating out of garbage cans. And you walk by them. Do you ever stop and say, why is this person in a country that has our gross national product eating out of a garbage can? Why on the Upper West Side, where more baby boomer yuppies from hell live than any place else in the world? And, of course, they're not going to stop. No, they can't. Their psyche doesn't allow them. It's an abomination. I watch it every day. So we have to do something. And so what I did was, over the last year, and it took a year, I finally reestablished the Nutrition Institute of America, which is a nonprofit, tax-exempt foundation, and it's going to have several purposes, and one of them is to help raise some funds from people who want to contribute to this. I contributed the first amount out of my own pocket. And Charlie Ginsburg, thank you very much, Charlie. Charlie, who's a very conscientious human being, he just volunteered, and because that's the way he is, when he heard what I was doing, and it was just in a casual conversation. But that's it. And if I can get enough money in there, then what I can do is I can take these people who don't have any place to go, who shouldn't be in a pilgrim state being shocked or drugged, and then pay to get them into some of these other recovery clinics that will not shock them, that will not use neuroleptics, that will give them chelation to get the toxic metals out, a holistic dentist to go in, to take the mercury out of their fillings, comprehensive neurological treatment to rebalance their brain serotonin levels and dopamine levels, to rejuvenate their organs and glands that have been utterly polluted. But that takes time and that takes money. Now, I give my time for free, as it is. I've never charged any one of the 44,000 people I've personally counseled. But giving your time for free, even buying vitamins for people for free, which I do every day, is not the same as being able to afford $10,000 for a six-month stay at one of these clinics. It's actually inexpensive, but it's still $10,000 for one human being. My idea is if we get about 50 of these people who have gotten from an institution into a healthier environment and changed, then have another group of board-certified psychologists re-examine these people and then say, does this person have schizophrenia? No. Well, they were originally diagnosed as schizophrenic. Have you ever heard of a schizophrenic becoming a non-schizophrenic in 6 months? No. So what does that tell you? A, it has been overdiagnosed. B, it is not a legitimate illness that we have tried to make symptoms into a legitimate illness. And C, that we have missed the boat on how we should be impacting people before we put them into these terrible environments. Same way with people who are manic depressed or bipolar depressed. Right now, we have no place. Now, I'm working now. I've already started to try to find a location to build from scratch, and it'll happen. It's a dream. Don't have a nickel to do it with, but I'll do it in time. Every dream can be a reality if we believe in it. Nothing becomes a reality if we don't. But I believe that there's room in this world for a holistic recovery center where everything there, from the yoga, meditation, the aromatherapy, and the aromatherapy, and the juicing, and the body therapies, and Vlasso, and hydrotherapies, and mud packs, and nature, and animals, I believe all that is a much better environment than walking in and seeing someone in a four-point restraint on a bed, being given an intravenous tranquilizer, and then taken out to being given electric shock therapy, then thrown out on the street when the insurance stops paying for it, and stigmatized. So that's my dream. And I don't know when it'll become a reality, but I'm working towards it. Because that's a big group of people. Right now, 55 million people fit into that category. So there's no shortage of people who need help. Anyhow, at least now there is one step closer to being able to help one of them. And this one guy we're trying to get out, but the trouble is we can't get him out of Pilgrim State, where we've gotten the psychiatrist and the judge and everyone to agree, because we have no place to take him. And he has to be under care. That's part of the court order. But he doesn't have to be under that draconian care. He can be under, they've agreed, he can be under a holistic care. It's a lot of work. Dozens of hours. Gary Krupp has spent over 30 hours in the last 2 weeks on just this one case. We already got that other person out. And for all of you who were at the hearings, the woman who came in about her brother, we've gotten him help. He's out of that environment. He's now getting into a holistic recovery environment. It's one at a time. People say, well, what's the point? Christ, you're talking about 55 million people need help and millions being institutionalized, and you're up against the pharmaceutical industry, doesn't want to lose that business, and so you help two people. Who cares? The two people we help care. Don't look at the numbers. If you can help one human being stop their suffering and regain the spiritual connection to their life, it's something. So it's not the masses. You can't. I never look at what I can't do. I look at what I can do. So anyhow, now we do have a nonprofit tax exempt foundation. It's called the Nutrition Institute of America. And if you want more information, you want to help get these people out, you can call Gary Krupp in my office at 646-505-4660. And he has donated over 30 hours of his personal time per week for the last 4 months, just trying to help these people. And that's a very noble deed. That's a special, special kind of person. Those are not the kind that are too often found. Let's go to the phones and say hello. See what's your issue. What's your name, please? You're
Gary?
On me. Yes.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate you. I wanted to ask you. I really was hoping to address more than one issue, but the main concern is. I know a while ago you had a speaker from a group who was involved with ADD children, and they were doing something at home. Now, I used to work with children in a school, and so many little children were immediately put on Ritalin if they were a little bit hype or whatnot. Now I have boys of my own, and they're extremely active. And I'm just trying to get involved in some kind of a home group. I live up in Rockland. I'm willing to use my home where we could have support groups. But I know there's something out there. I don't have access to an internet right now. And I know you have a lot on your website. But I was hoping that you could give me some channel or, you know, some other parents that are concerned where we could seek. I know it's imperative that we spend time with them, that we do activities with them, that we interact and show them a lot of love, et cetera. But I'm just wondering if there's some kind of a protocol or something that we could use as a guide that maybe you could just quickly give me a little input.
Okay, let's look at it from several different points of view.
A close friend of my husband that's on the phone, and he's got...
If I were a 12-year-old boy today, I would clearly be diagnosed with probably multiple mental illnesses. No question about that. Why? Because of my energy level. A friend of mine, Steve Weider, who I hadn't seen since I was a teenager, once I graduated from high school, and he didn't. He went off to college one direction, I went another direction. But we'd grown up from the age of two together. And we recently reconnected. And it was a wonderful connection. What was funny is all the stories that Steve told me about what I was like from his impression growing up as a kid together. And he's followed me over the years through my career. And he says, Gary, you're no different today than when you were a little boy. You were always creative. You always did everything different. Nothing was ever like anybody else. And I see that you're just doing the same thing today. You're just a grown-up version of what you were there. And I hadn't thought about that. And I thought about, gee whiz, what happens to all the boys and girls who just have very excited minds? They're excited about it each day. They wake up and they want to look out the window and see what's going on out there. I remember my mother would say, all right, it's 8 o'clock, go to sleep. And especially in the summertime, it's not even dark. And I'd say, but someone else is still awake. And she'd say, Gary Michael, she says, but it's 8 o'clock. I said, but Mom, I can't go to sleep if I know other people are out there awake and doing something. And she'd look at me and she'd laugh and she'd say, well, what does they're doing something have to do with you being in bed? Well, I don't want to be in bed. I want to know that when I go to sleep, everyone else is asleep too. So even though I wasn't with those people, she'd say, all right. So I would do little inventions and crafts and anything I wanted until I was so tired, then I'd go to sleep. Which is probably where I got one of my habits of staying up late. I'm up working almost every night till 2 a.m, and then I get up early. And today that kind of attitude would get you classified as attention deficit disordered. My great concern is how many innocent, wonderful young children are being stigmatized because they're energetic. Energy can come from several directions and come from just the indomitable spirit of a human being. Look at any group of animals. If you have a mare that has two folds, one will not have the same energy or personality as the other. No two litters are ever the same. No two kittens or puppies are ever the same. No two calves are ever the same. You might get one that goes bucking all over the place and comes up and nudges you nonstop. Another one's kind of laid back and quiet. Well, you don't say one's diseased and one is not. So we've made just being energized by life a problem. Next, what about those people who are quiet and introspective? I see that as a life energy of an adaptive supportive. They're not braggarts. They're not show-offs. They tend to be quiet. They don't want to take center stage. They much prefer being a supportive, passive person in the audience than active and taking the bows. They're the type of person that becomes a farmer or a cab driver or a school bus driver or a seamstress or a person that will spend their whole life working at the best they can to help another human being. They don't ask a lot. They don't demand a lot. In fact, they frequently feel uncomfortable if they're given too much attention. Today, we've made that a shyness disorder. It's not. These are naturally inclined to be less aggressive. That's not a disease. That's an asset. Does every instrument in the orchestra have to be at the same level? No. There's some very subtle. And some more, some of the percussions, very, very raw, very strong. We want everyone to fit one mold. We're not the same. Then you have people who are just very dynamic. They're charismatic. They're going to be speaking before they're spoken to. They're going to have opinions, right or wrong. That's fine. Let someone have an opinion, especially someone growing up. Let them give you their impression of the world. Don't be there just to keep correcting. One of the mistakes of being a parent is we don't trust that our children will evolve beyond what we teach them. So we're more concerned that they learn what we believe is right rather than giving them any capacity to create a rightness for themselves. So those children are going to be found needing a diagnosis. Creative children in particular are susceptible because creative people tend to look at the world with a totally different vision. And they need time alone. Then they need intense time with people. Their conversations are not the same as an adaptive supportive. They generally become extremely intense. That's fine. That's who they are. Take away that intensity, as we've done historically to almost every creative person, by challenging them to owe up to some normal design. Act like everyone else. They can't. Thank God they're not like everyone else. They're unique. Respect them for their uniqueness. Otherwise, it's like looking at all butterflies and saying they should all be brown. What about the monarch? No, it doesn't matter. Then it's a disease. Something's wrong with it. Let's cure it. Make it brown like all the other colors. Then you have, what is it that we do to these personalities that could overexcite them? Caffeine from colas, from coffee, from sugar, from excitotoxins, cerebral allergies, from the foods like corn and wheat and dairy and meat and artificial sweeteners, MSG. And then no two children will be motivated or stimulated by an environment in the same way. We have really changed in the quality of our teaching. I'm so happy for the time that I had in my life because my teachers, though I didn't like them all and I didn't have the same energy in each class, today it is a miracle that most kids get through any class without having these kind of hassles. And yet there are very good teachers, they're very decent teachers, but they're in the minority today. Not the majority, because the whole profession of teaching has changed and its significance and its social standing and the difficulties. We've made it enormously difficult for teachers to teach the way they should. So you must consider all these things before you let anyone or yourself be biased to buy into the idea that your children suffer from this imaginary condition. That said, then take a look in the book, The Food, Mood, Body Connection. I have a lot of material in there on natural approaches to helping detoxify and balance brain chemistry in people who may have been toxic or are and need to be rebalanced. So that would certainly be something that you could start with. Because you ask most parents, what would you do to detoxify from the diet? And they have no idea what you're talking about. And it's not just about throwing a few nutrients into the mix each day. It's about really making a shift and having your children understand it. Read the material themselves. Talk about it. Dialogue about it. Now, we've just completed a support group for attention deficit disorder and ADHD with great success. Great, great success. The results of that will be up on GaryNull.com. And if you want, and by the way, anyone in any of the groups who want to start their own support system to continue can. And if you put your name up there on GaryNull.com that you would like to have people in your area do a support group, I'm sure you'll get people who will join you in that. All right? Let's take another call. What's your name? Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a question about exercise. What nutrients should a man take before and after a workout? Why and within what period of time?
What kind of workout?
Anaerobic and aerobic, both types.
Okay, you should take some branched chain amino acids because they will help expand the protoplasm. Before a workout, you'll want to take a liquefied complex carbohydrate drink, like a vegetable protein drink. That will sustain your glycogen and glucose level. Pyruvate, if you're going to be doing a lot of intense muscle workout, and at least a pint to a quart of liquid, preferably with electrolytes. So watermelon juice is ideal if you're going to do a run or bike. And you want to make also sure that you have L-glutamine, generally about 1,000 milligrams, because it can sustain the benefits of a workout without creating a lactic acid buildup. DMG, dimethylglycine, about 100 milligrams before, because it prevents muscle fatigue. Vitamin E at 400 units also spaces the oxygen, so you're more oxygenated, which is good. And coenzyme Q10 at about 100 milligrams because it protects your heart by supplying the branched chain acids, fatty acids, which the heart needs for the mitochondria, which is the energy, and also magnesium at about 500 milligrams. I wouldn't go higher because you get diarrhea when you're exercising, but that helps keep the muscles loose and open. And that would be your exercise regime.
Have you written any books on the subject?
Yes, I have. I have a book called Ultimate Training. And we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening and calling in. And all next week, I'll be taking calls on the air. And hope that you have a good couple days coming up. For those of you who live in the tri-state New York City area, you can listen Sunday evening to my two radio shows. I have one from 8 to 9 on WNEW FM. That's 102.7 FM, 8 to 9. From 9 to 10, I'm on for 12 years, WEVD, 1050 AM on the dial. So it's 8 to 9 on WNEW, 9 to 10 on WEVD, 2 hours, and I'll be taking lots of calls. Have a very nice weekend, everyone.